Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking about a new twist in the debate over abortion today. It's from an article in Free Inquiry magazine, and frankly, it is one of the scariest things I've read in a very long time. This particular bioethicist is arguing that the way past the abortion impasse is to make a distinction between human beings and human persons. Human beings have no natural right to life, he says, but human persons do. That qualification, that distinction means everything, and we're going to be talking about that coming up in the second segment. First, a review of issues in the news that are pressing. Nothing more impressing here in Louisville, Kentucky today than having President George W. Bush come to town. That's about as impressive as it gets. And I had the opportunity to give the invitation at the invocation at that meeting and also to hear the president as he spoke about Social Security. That was his main topic. And as you know, the president is going all over the country talking about the Social Security issue. I want to make just a couple of observations about this. We're going to have to wait till we have a specific legislative proposal in order to understand fully where all this is going. But I have to say, in the second administration, those presidents who get a second administration, it is generally, given the historical pattern, a time of retrenchment and less ambitious programs. And I just say hats off to this president because he is pushing this hard. He's put his administration, his place in history on the line, not only domestically in terms of this Social Security initiative, but also internationally in terms of this emphasis upon democracy and confrontation with the axis of evil that he is continuing to exercise as president, to lead as president in his second term. But let me go back to his comments today. The president, in talking about Social Security, set out a couple of big-picture issues that really should have our attention as Christians. One of those big-picture issues is the role of government. What should the role of government be in something like Social Security, in a social welfare safety net, as it is known by many? You know, what is government's proper role in this? That's not a small question. That's a big question. But another question is the obligation of one generation to another. And this is a big one. And the president demonstrated that today on the platform by having a grandfather and his granddaughter. As a matter of fact, he had two grandfathers and two granddaughters. And he made very clear that Social Security is not a crisis for those who are now retirees or soon to face retirement. But it is a crisis. If you're a 21 or a 22-year-old, you have to know that the Social Security fund is going to be in deficit by the time that you retire. And so the president was really both explicitly in terms of the words he used and implicitly, and I would argue very powerfully in terms of the symbolism of having these people on stage with him, he was making this point. It is very easy for a generation to just pass off problems to a subsequent generation. And that's just not right. And this Social Security issue needs to be fixed. And in the fixing of it, I can guarantee you we're going to have a great national debate on an entire host of issues that really will matter, including the role of government, what one generation owes another, and just how we should understand an individual's right to control any part of his or her retirement fund as administered by the government. Bad news on the front in Tampa, Florida, in the Florida case of Terry Schiavo. The bad news is this. Judge Greer has now ordered that the Department of Health and Family Services cannot intervene to delay the withdrawal of hydration and food from Terry Schiavo effective next week. Now, there are still other initiatives underway. We are not without hope. I mean, after all, we have Terry's parents still pushing several fronts. There are initiatives in Congress, both the Senate and the House in Washington, to consider immediate emergency legislation that would offer an opportunity for a review of Judge Greer's decision by the federal courts. There are many other initiatives going on, many of them just plainly bathed in prayer for Terry Schiavo. We need to be reminded again of what's at stake. This is a woman who is, by some accounts, in a vegetative state, but by other accounts, not in a vegetative state. But I want to tell you, whether or not she's in a vegetative state, she does not deserve to be starved to death. This is judicially applied murder, and we need to call it what it is. Now, there is a new and interesting twist in all of this, and I want to tell you about it. The judge in this case, Judge George W. Greer of the Pinellas Pasco Circuit Court there in Florida, is a member of a Baptist church. He is a member of a Southern Baptist church in Clearwater, Florida. And he now feels that it is unfair that his fellow Christians are criticizing him. Now, this is an unfolding story, and I want to tell you, from a Christian perspective, they don't get much more important than this. Because what we're going to see here is the intersection of Christian responsibility and the life of the local congregation. There are people in his church who are now saying, we have a church member who has become an extension of the culture of death. Judge Greer is complaining that he's getting angry emails. He is claiming that he is otherwise conservative. He is a member of this church in Clearwater, Florida, and he now says that that he is so upset with this church that he is not attending any longer and he's cut off giving. Well, what about the church? Obviously, this church now faces a significant challenge as well. I'll be talking to you about this because this is an unfolding story, and I'm going to tell you both how this church and others are responding to this particular challenge. But I want to tell you, the good news for me right now is that there are Christians who know this judge, who are confronting him with the error of his judgment and his ways and his actions in relation to this case. That's good news. That is a note that has been missing for far too long, and now there is good news that there is that controversy afoot. Last night, Dan Rather signed off after 24 years as anchor and as managing editor of the CBS Evening News. And there were an awful lot of people who wanted to hear what he would have to say. You know, final words mean a whole lot. In this case, not his last words on earth, but his last words on the air as CBS anchor, given all the controversy, all the activity, all of the interest swirling around Dan Rather. The big question is, what would he say? Listen to his final words.
Not long after I first came to the anchor chair, I briefly signed off using the word courage. I want to return to it now in a different way. To a nation still nursing a broken heart for what happened in 2001, and especially to those who found themselves closest to the events of September 11th. To our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in dangerous places. To those who have endured the tsunami, and to all who have suffered natural disasters, and who must now find the will to rebuild. To the oppressed and to those whose lot it is to struggle in financial hardship or in failing health. To my fellow journalists in places where reporting the truth means risking all. And to each of you, courage. For the CBS Evening News, Dan Rather reporting. Good night.
Well, there you have it. You know, I can remember back when Dan Rather started ending his broadcast with that word courage. And it just sounded so strange. No one actually even knew what he was up to. It became the butt of jokes. You started hearing the late-night comedians making fun of this. You started hearing people on the street turn to each other with seriousness and go, courage. That wasn't good. But Dan Rather returned to it. You have to say this. This is a man with some measure of courage. To go back to that as the last word he would speak as CBS News anchor. Fascinating 24-year career. It was in 1961 that Dan Rather catapulted to fame during coverage of Texas and its impact by Hurricane Carla. And then it was in 1974, it was President Richard Nixon who confronted Dan Rather in what became a very well-known, if awkward, confrontation. When President Nixon responded to Dan Rather very tartly by saying, Dan, are you running for something? And Dan Rather turned to the president and said, no, Mr. President, are you? It was a breach of protocol, both on the part of the president and this reporter, and it was long remembered. Dan Rather was also a figure, accidentally, as it turned out, in reporting the news from the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. This man's had a very long journalistic career. 24 years ago, he became the anchor and managing editor, chief editor of the CBS Evening News. Fascinating editorial in yesterday's edition of the Tampa Tribune about Dan Rather. I just want to read you this. It says, Rather stayed on the air too long. He exists, as our colleague Walt Belcher said Tuesday, as perhaps the most uncomfortable anchor in America. A nation of TV watchers never trusted Rather the way we trusted Cronkite, and we never liked him as much as Brokaw. Perhaps that was because he was a more natural reporter than a neutral news reader. Later on in the editorial, it says this, but while Rather gloried in his role as maverick reporter, he gave short shrift to his role as skeptical editor, and it hurt him. Well, it's very interesting to see one branch of the media critique another. But I think this editorial is onto something. Dan Rather was a reporter. A reporter needs an editor. When he tried to be his own editor, disaster ensued. And the liberal bent of his own political perspective and worldview came out, and there is no editor to correct him. Dan Rather has never come to terms with the debacle over George W. Bush's National Guard service and the embarrassment that that brought when Dan Rather and his colleagues were using, obviously, forged documents. Accountability sometimes is delayed, but it is never delayed for long. We'll be back to discuss the issue of abortion in a new and very frightening light. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back, America. You know, the issue of abortion has been so hotly debated now in America for over 30 years that you may think you've heard everything, but I don't think so. You may think that you've heard the pro-abortion argument put forth in its many different ways, and you've already taken all that into account. Well, there are those who advocate abortion who are now rethinking how to make the case for abortion. And the most remarkable article along these lines I've seen is by a man by the name of Andrew Johnson. He holds a Ph.D. in bioethics and philosophy from the University of North Carolina, where he has taught courses in bioethics. He has written an article entitled How Not to Argue for Abortion Rights, and it's published in the February-March issue of Free Inquiry magazine. Now, that's a magazine on the political left, and in fact, I've written about that in my internet commentary, talked about it on the air. But what you see in this magazine and in this particular article is the shape of the future on the question of abortion. And it is, as I've already said, about as frightening as anything I have ever read. I read this as I was on the airplane the other day, and I just simply could not get it out of my mind. I wrote my internet commentary about this article, and it was published on Tuesday. You can find it by going to albertmueller.com and just look under the internet commentary. Go back to Tuesday, and you will find it. I want to tell you what Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson, is doing in this article. Number one, he is arguing that the pro-abortion movement is losing steam and is losing political capital. Now, I agree with him on that. I don't agree with him with much in this article, but where I agree with him strongly. I agree with him that the pro-abortion movement is running out of steam. Now, the evidence of that is, for instance, the successful passage of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, the successful passage of the laws that in many states have been very clear about parental notification. Even where the courts have struck those down, there is clear popular support for those laws. Polls, surveys, studies indicate that the vast majority of Americans are very uncomfortable with abortion on demand. And for that reason, and just remember, we have abortion on demand in this country, not because of a legislative action, not because the people of the United States demanded it, but because a simple majority on the U.S. Supreme Court decided it in 1973. That's why. But how not to argue for abortion rights? The article by Andrew Sullivan, what does he say? He says that the pro-abortion movement has been using wrong arguments. The wrong arguments. He says some of them are unsustainable, some of them are simply false. Now, you've got to hear what he's doing in this article. Listen to this. He says, argument number one that the pro-abortionists use is this. A fetus or embryo or zygote is not yet a human being, a living human being, and thus it is not wrong to kill it. He comes back and says, that's simply not true. The fetus is alive. We know it now. In pre-modern times, it was perhaps justifiable to pinpoint the beginning of life at quickening. That's the baby's discernible movement in the womb. This being the first externally observable sign of life. Modern technology, however, has revealed to us that even the zygote, formed by the union of sperm and egg, is an organism that is continuously growing and developing. The second claim is that the fetus is a human being. This claim is rendered true by the fetus's possession of a complete human genetic code programmed to direct the development of a human body. Now, folks, don't miss this. This is a pro-abortionist arguing that the abortion rights side of the argument has been using false, patently, obviously false arguments. And the first one is that the fetus is not a living human being, and thus it is not wrong to kill it. He says it is a living human being. Stay tuned. There's more. He holds up pro-abortion argument number two. Early to midterm fetuses lack moral standing because they are not yet viable. He comes back and says that's ridiculous. That is not an intrinsic characteristic of the fetus, but it's a relational characteristic. And he furthermore says, let's face it, viability is going younger and younger and younger and younger. A 28-week-old fetus had no hope of surviving outside his mother's womb in 1900, but by 2000, technological advances had given it quite favorable prospects in such a circumstance. Listen to this next sentence. Yet it cannot plausibly be thought that the moral standing of a 28-week-old fetus was different in 1900 and 2000. That's a shot right across the abortion rights movement. Argument three used by the abortionists. Abortion must be kept legal so that it remains safe. Criminalizing abortion will lead to back alley abortions with coat hangers, endangering the health and lives of women who sought abortions. He comes back and he says, that's ridiculous, because it begs the question of whether abortion itself is an evil, and that it will be worth, morally speaking, having abortion criminalized, even if that would lead to back alley abortions, if it would save a specific and large number of babies who would otherwise be aborted. That's clear thinking. He's with us on this one. Argument number four, abortion must be kept legal because criminalizing abortion would infringe a woman's right to privacy. Now, isn't that the one we hear more than anything else? You see, I think right now this is the first argument being used by the abortion rights movement. It's about a woman's right to choose. It's necessary for her equality. He comes back and says, that's ridiculous too, because it's not just about the woman. It's about the woman and a baby. This is not just a woman's suffrage movement issue. The woman's claim to equality is not absolute, and it comes into conflict with what he or she takes to be another human being's inviolable right to life. Argument number six, used by the abortionists, a right to abortion follows from a woman's right to control her body. So good so far, says Mr. Johnson, but it's not just about her body. It's also about the body of the fetus. And thus the argument that it's just about a woman's body and about her liberty to define her own body and what happens to it, it runs aground on the fact that it's the baby's body, another individual human being's body, that is destroyed in the abortion. There's more. He takes these arguments apart one by one. What he says here is that the entire abortion rights movement is based upon arguments that are, these are his words, either question-begging or unsound. So where's he going to go from here? After all, I've already told you, he's for abortion. He wants the abortion rights movement to reframe its argument. But where do you go if you knock down all six of those arguments? Well, you go to something new. Now, it's not absolutely and categorically new, because others have made this argument before. But I have never seen anyone argue that the pro-abortion movement, the abortion rights movement in America, should take this argument as its main argument. That's the new part of this. That Mr. Johnson's arguing that the way forward in the abortion rights debate to defend the right of abortion is to make this argument. What's his argument? Listen to this. There are human beings who are not persons. That's it. He says we need to concede that the unborn baby, now notice, not just from the moment of late-term pregnancy, but from the moment of conception. He says from the moment of conception, we should recognize that this is a living human being. And then he says, so what? That doesn't mean it's a person. He says a human person has to have certain characteristics. What kind of characteristics? Intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. Where you do not have those qualifications, he says, where you do not have those characteristics and qualities, you do not have a human person. A human being, he says, does not have any innate right to life, only human persons. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the ethicist, the ethical principles, the ethical framework of the Third Reich. If we make a distinction between human beings and human persons, then we can kill anybody. We can come up with a list of qualifications of what it takes to be a human person, and we can decide that on racial grounds, educational grounds, we can decide that on grounds of intelligence, we can decide that on whatever grounds we want. That's exactly what happened in Nazi Germany. That's how you ended up with the death camps. Auschwitz, Birkenau, Treblinka, that's where this leads. Mr. Johnson says he thinks this will sell in America because it will cut off the pro-lifers who are arguing that the fetus is a living human being. He'll simply concede that and say, yes, it is a living human being, but so what? It's not a human person. Listen to this statement. Mere membership in the species Homo sapiens should no more accord moral standing to human beings than mere membership in Culex pipiens accords moral standing to common house mosquitoes. That's right. Human life, no more important than insect life. Until Mr. Johnson decides we have a person. I think we have a topic for conversation. Give me a call, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This is too important not to address. It's time for you to call, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, America. We're talking about the issue of abortion in a dark new light. The light of one who is now making the argument that we must make a distinction between human beings and human persons. Human beings are expendable. Human persons are to be accorded certain rights. Andrew Johnson's making this argument in the February-March issue of Free Inquiry magazine. His article's entitled, How Not to Argue for Abortion Rights. In a fascinating series of paragraphs, he just destroys all the common and customary pro-abortion arguments. He proves that they are either, as he says, question begging or just baseless. But what he does next is nearly breathtaking in its evil nature. He says we just need to go on and argue, take as the main point of a pro-abortion argument, the fact that it is lawful and it's not immoral to kill living human beings who are not, by his definition, living human persons. Now, folks, let's just talk about what it means to be human for a moment. You know, this is just one of the most important issues we could face. What does it take for you to be recognized as human? Now, I'm going to give you a Christian worldview perspective on that. Grounded in Scripture, we come to understand that human beings are special, significant, set apart from all the rest of creation, even all the other thinking beings, because we alone are made in the image of God. Therefore, every single human being, from the moment of conception, is made in the image of God. Being human means that you have dignity and should be accorded full respect simply because you are made in the image of God. There's no further qualification necessary. But right now, in the world of philosophy, in the world of ethics, and apparently in the world of law, there is a debate as to whether being a human being also means you're a human person. And there are some who are arguing that to be a human person, you have to have certain qualities. Dr. Johnson, the author of this article, lists intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. Peter Singer at Princeton University, one of the most dangerous men in the entire world, I would argue, in a chair of bioethics at Princeton University, argues that newborn infants and very young children do not yet possess these capacities. Thus, he has argued in print that for a mother to kill her own living child should not be considered murder if the child has not yet acquired these characteristics. And as I recall, he lists communicative ability among those characteristics. So before a child learns to communicate, he or she is just simply not a person. And if he's not a person, then it's all right to kill him, according to Peter Singer, by the way, who is quoted in this article, and Douglas Johnson, the author of this particular article. I want to know what you think about this. This is a seductive logic that fits the culture of death perfectly. If you were writing a cultural script for the pro-abortion movement, if you were writing a recipe for cultural and social and civilizational disaster, I don't think you could do any better than this. I want you to hear another statement he makes. Listen to this. The denial of fetal personhood, incidentally, is not a denial that a healthy, late-term fetus has developed a number of mental capacities, among them a degree of perception, memory, and susceptibility to pleasure and pain, capacities that pro-lifers are fond of pointing out. What pro-lifers fail to notice, however, is that these capacities don't elevate the moral status of the fetus above that of a typical farm animal, which is clearly not a person. Indeed, on account of their greater intelligence, mature farm animals resemble persons more than fetuses do. To imply otherwise by brandishing images that display fetuses' humanoid appearance is to commit the fallacy of speciesism. Arms and legs and fingers and toes are not the basis of moral standing. End quote. Did you hear that? Do you understand what he's saying here? He is saying that just looking like a human being and being a human being by identification with the human species is not enough to say that your life is meaningful at all. Now, if this can be true of fetuses, as Mr. Johnson is arguing that it is, it can be true of Jews. It can be true of gypsies. It can be true of homosexuals, three groups targeted by the Third Reich as life unworthy of life. It can be true of any group we would want to identify, any group we would want to exterminate. This is the logic of genocide. It is the logic of the culture of death. It's the logic that is put forth in this article. And he is arguing beyond the argument itself, that it should become the platform, the basis, for the public argumentation of the abortion rights movement. We see the reality clearly now. This article helps us to see what we're up against. Ladies and gentlemen, are you willing to accept a distinction between human beings and human persons? Join this conversation by calling 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The moment we accept that distinction, we've just bargained away human life. The precise nature of the disaster that follows is just a question of choice and circumstance, no longer of principle. 877-893-8255 is the number. Give me a call. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back, America. We're talking about this new argument on behalf of abortion. Truly frightening. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've read anything lately that has sent chills down my spine like this particular article. And its author, Andrew Johnson, writing in Free Inquiry magazine, simply argues that we need to make a distinction between human beings and human persons, and those who don't fit his definition of personhood can be exterminated, killed, whether in the womb, obviously, or later. There's no reason why this logic doesn't apply to beings outside of the womb, to human persons outside the womb. Let's go to Frank calling from Cleveland, listening on WHK Radio. Frank, go right ahead.
Dr. Mohler, thank you for taking my call. And by the way, my compliments to you on your crosswalk commentary today. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, thank you.
I think we owe this gentleman a debt of thanks, really, because he has very clearly pointed out the logical absurdity of the rationale behind the culture of death. And for the folks out there who aren't familiar with this guy, you can read his bio in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 3 through 5. I mean, as soon as I read your crosswalk commentary regarding this ethicist, it immediately brought that passage to mind.
Yeah, I can understand why, Frank. And I think you're right. I agree with you entirely when you say he's done us a favor by writing this article. Now, I'm scared to death by the ideas in it, because I realize that these are not just his ideas. As a matter of fact, he footnotes others, most specifically Peter Singer, whom I've mentioned, from Princeton University. But I think what we're seeing is desperation on the pro-abortion side, and that's leading to the fact that they're running out of arguments, and this is about all they have left. And this is the raw face of the abortion argument right here, that some human beings simply don't deserve to live. Frank, thanks for your call. I really appreciate it. And I think when we start thinking about articles like this, we realize that we've got to read the other side's mail. I mean, that's the bottom line. We have to read what they're talking about. And that's why in my commentary and on this radio program, I try to look at the arguments being made by the other side so that we can know what we're up against. For far too long, Christians have been outthought by the world. And it's because, quite frankly, they are out in front of us pushing for these issues before we often have arguments against them. That caught the church by surprise in 1973. It must not be true now. Let's go to Bill, also calling from Cleveland on WHK. Bill, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. The last caller, I agree with what he's saying to a certain extent, but it scares me that this is being said out there. I mean, on one hand, it sounds almost so absurd and unbelievable that, you know, nobody could possibly agree with this guy. But then again, you know, abortion is legal in the United States right now. So obviously an absurd concept is, you know, something a lot of people will buy into.
Yeah, Bill, hang on with me here for a minute. I want to tell you that you're so right that I could take you to faculty members in esteemed American universities and graduate seminars in philosophy and biomedical ethics, and you'd find people who would agree with this man.
Right.
The fact is, there are just so many Americans who have no idea about it, and that's why I wanted to give it attention. I think we've got to talk about this. You had another point. Go right ahead.
Well, the fact that, you know, he was talking about the a barnyard animal having, you know, being more human-like. Well, that barnyard animal will never be, in his words, a human person. That human being at least has that potential, and even if it's not going to be a fully functioning human being, or in the case of like Terry Schiavo, who was at one time a fully functioning human being and now has lost that, well, to this guy, he would be snuffing her out in a moment's notice either. I mean,
yeah.
You had mentioned that this is the epitome of the culture of death. Who's going to define what a human person is. I mean,
well, Andrew Johnson is, Bill. Andrew Johnson's right here with his list. Now, thankfully, you're not going to accept it, nor am I. But I'm fascinated by this. The list could be, it does say intelligence. Well, how high in intelligence? You know, what about a child with Down syndrome? What about someone who's had a mental injury, a brain injury? You know, this is just about as frightening as it gets. Bill, you pointed us towards some of the key issues here. We're going to go very quickly to Joan calling from Louisville, listening on WFIA. Joan, go right ahead.
Hi. Just adding on to where you left off, I mean, if we started making up a list of all of the people that this could apply to, look at all the people in nursing homes with Alzheimer's. I can't remember everything that he had on his ridiculous list of what qualifies you to be a human person, quote unquote, but you could twist this around to make it whatever you want it to be if it were convenient that you were someone who wanted this person to not be around anymore. Alzheimer's, what about people with autism? Not just little babies, but the Terry Schiavos of the world who've had an injury. Who gets to decide where this moral issue is? Because isn't one of the things on the list something to do with the ability to make moral decisions?
Yeah, moral responsibility. Joan, you know, you're looking at the nursing home, and so am I. And look at the homes. I really appreciate the fact you brought up, for instance, a child with autism. His list, I'm going to read it again, intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. Then he says among others, so that's not a complete list. But, you know, a child with autism, especially a severe form of autism, it may be alleged, doesn't have a future regarding intention. And doesn't have a proper self-awareness or moral responsibility. You know, Joan, you're looking in all the right places, because with this logic, you could go through the nursing homes and say, out with you, you, and you. You could go to the places where there would be people who are mentally handicapped being helped. You could go through and say, out with you, and you. Maybe all of you. You could go to the one with deformity. Maybe someone who just can't take care of themselves, and you could say the same thing. It reminds me of what we know from the historical record about Josef Mengele, the infamous Nazi doctor who stood in places like I stood at Dachau and with my family just this past summer, and then Auschwitz and others, and they would simply point and say, you live, you die, you live, you die, you live, you die, you live, you die. Why? Just because that's the way he felt. Maybe this one looked like he could work in the concentration camp. Maybe that one looked like she couldn't. This is the culture of death, absolutely naked before our eyes. Let's go to Joe very quickly, calling from Cincinnati on WTSJ. Joe, go right ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to point out some of the intellectual dishonesty of the argument the professor is making. And I think as a Christians, we need to go from an intellectual standpoint. One of the things the other caller said was about the capacity for a fetus to become a human, and he likens that to a farm animal. I think we have to just keep pointing out that, you know, they try to frame it as a snapshot in time, and they don't want to look at the capacity that a human has to grow, and I just think that.
Yeah, Joe, that point was also made by an earlier caller who pointed out that a baby is a potential human being, human person, by even this list of criteria. The problem is, what about those persons who are not able to develop in this way? I'm going to argue with all my heart that they also are human persons, fully made in the image of God, fully deserving of our protection. I don't think you disagree with that, Joe, but I just want to say that cognitive ability, it does set us apart from the animals. But what if a human being loses that ability? I don't think they cease to be human. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. There are no issues more important than this. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, folks, you can count on the fact we're going to be tracking this issue for you. This is an argument that is being newly inserted into the public square and to an incredibly tragic effect, I'm afraid. And we're going to be following this because it shows you the logic of the culture of death right out in front and forward. Just at the last of our caller segment, we had Rob calling from Iowa who wanted to make the point that Mr. Johnson is himself a speciesist. Well, you know, that's an interesting point, isn't it? It's because when you think about this list that he came up with to identify human persons, lest we be a speciesist, he lists intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. What's fascinating is he holds out the possibility that there are human non-persons and non-human persons. He thinks some animals can achieve personhood. Well, you know what? Mr. Johnson, I'll take that seriously. when my beagle shows up with his list that I have to meet in order to be considered a person. I'm not going to stay up late at night for that one. This is the idiocy of those who, in the name of political correctness, have simply lost their minds. But this isn't a mind game. This isn't a merely theoretical issue. This is about life and death. This is about life and death when it comes to someone like Terry Schiavo in Florida. You realize that this argument is immediately applicable there. Because according to Dr. Johnson's set of criteria, she is still a human being, but she's no longer a human person. Since she's no longer a human person, we can starve her to death, dehydrate her to death. This is an argument that is used of those who are profoundly deformed at birth, a profoundly substandard according to certain standards that are set by medical authorities. In today's New York Times, an incredible article about the Groningen Protocol. We talked about that. That's that list of criteria set up by doctors in the Netherlands by which they justify killing newborns who do not fit their criteria for life. They suggest these newborns are going to face a lifetime of pain. Therefore, it is lawful and ethical to kill them. These are not merely theoretical issues. As a matter of fact, when it comes to the most important issues of life, they may start at the level of theory, but very quickly they work their way down to the level of life. And at the level of life, they become legislation. They become medical protocols. They become principles and policies. They become ways and habits of life. And that's the insidious nature of all this. That's the truly haunting nature of this article. It's not only that these ideas are held by Douglas Johnson and by several others who would agree with him. It's not only that these ideas are being taken seriously, as scary as this is, in many of the academic departments and philosophy and biomedical ethics and other fields in American universities. It's that these ideas, if you scratch the surface, are where an awful lot of Americans are, because they simply do not accept that every single human being is a human person made in the image of God. Let's remember, lest we forget. We'll be back tomorrow for more Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.